to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And a little later in the show, we're going to be talking about ways the media shapes your views on, well, everything, and also quite a bit about much of the controversy swirling and raging after the multiple occurrences, I guess we should say, as it concerns the issue of police murder and police brutality here in the United States. But before we can move on, as we pointed out on this show fairly consistently during the confirmation process of various cabinet secretaries, that people should be at least as worried about rule changes that require no congressional action as legislative changes as far as it concerns rolling back what many consider forward progress in things like the struggle for climate justice and civil rights. Now, at HUD, we have more evidence that this is, in fact, a major risk and something we should be paying attention to. At issue now is a request by 40 groups to Ben Carson, who's the Secretary of HUD, to rescind a gender identity-related rule in terms of HUD-financed or even partially financed homeless shelters. The so-called gender identity rule was issued in its final form in September of 2016 and requires any single-sex facility with, quote, funds awarded through the Department's Office of Community Planning and Development to, quote, be required to provide all individuals, including transgendered individuals and other individuals who do not identify with the sex they were assigned at birth, with access to programs, benefits, services, and accommodations in accordance with their gender identity without being subjected to intrusive questioning or being asked to provide documentation, end quote. Now, the 40 groups consist primarily of conservative groups, but also some so-called feminist groups that have of late made common cause with the religious right because they do not believe there's any fluidity or social construction in gender identity, and that it is fixed hard on biology. Either way, it is in a strictly conservative effort, which certainly will give Carson more cover. However, the issue of discrimination against trans women in homeless shelters is, in fact, not in question and quite significant. In a 2016 test case to see how bad the problem was, they broke them down into states that had some sort of LGBTQ protections and those who didn't. States with some sort of LGBTQ protections, 80% of women's shelters refused to house transgendered women, and in states with at least some protections for civil rights of the LGBTQ community, 60% of women's shelters still refuse to house people in accordance with their gender identity. And it isn't really an issue of preference, but one of safety. 55% of trans people in one study said they were harassed by shelter staff or residents, with 22% reporting sexual assaults. Further, the reason for the discrimination is just not even logical. It's based on this non-existent fallacy that trans women are really just men looking to sneak into women's bathrooms and so on and harass and assault people. Every single shred of evidence points in the exact opposite direction. There is literally, absolutely no major crisis of transgendered people secretly hiding their abusive nature behind their gender identity. In fact, it's just another version of the old gay panic defense we used to see in courts a lot, when gay men were viewed as so aggressively promiscuous, always on the lookout to lure men and boys into traps where they could rape them. It became acceptable in court to defend bigoted violence against gay people as self-defense. It was called the gay panic defense, as I just noted. So yet again, we have random fear-mongering and narrow-minded bigotry masquerading as science and policy, looking to lock tens of thousands of trans people, one-fifth of whom experience homelessness due to their gender identity, out of fair access to housing. So let's hope that HUD and Secretary Carson don't take the bait. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence has just published the 2016 Annual Surveillance Review, giving us our first glimpse into some of what various spying agencies, and particularly the NSA, are up to. Based on quote-unquote reforms put in place following Edward Snowden's release about the NSA spying, the NSA is now collecting metadata records, not just on everyone, but only on those the government says are terrorism suspects and then the people they talk to. So most people expected for there to be a significantly smaller number of records that were taken up by the NSA. Well, now we know that the number of records that was scooped up was 151 million based on investigations on 42 suspects. It's roughly 3.5 records 3.5 million records per suspect. Now, it's far less than the billions of records scooped up before, but the sheer numerical reduction the media and the NSA are really focusing on really is not the whole story. Now, the government points out that the 151 million is really sort of a too high number that people shouldn't take on its face value because it includes the same call counted twice by different service providers and also multiple calls to and from the same phone number. So their attitude is, hey, nothing to see here, really. It's just the natural call volume. However, they didn't even try to estimate the number of actual people this included, which right off the bat should give you some sense that, in fact, it's way more people than they want you to know. It certainly looks worse than they want people to know. Also, if you're one step removed from a suspect, it's all your calls, too. So, say I get tabbed because my friend is getting investigated, then they look into all my call metadata. And that's a big unexamined loophole as well. I mean, how are they weeding out the relevant and the non-relevant players? Any person who may or may not be a terrorist is in communication with potentially any number of non-terrorist subjects. And at what point they say, oh, this isn't germane. How far along the chain are they actually going? If a call seems maybe suspicious, are they tracking someone's metadata for a year? That may just be someone a potential suspect worked out with at the gym. The potential for abuse here and the gray areas of all this are pretty clear, and we still aren't really learning much from this new report. But what the report also doesn't reveal, and again, this is so crucial and a major point we've raised on this show, is how many Americans, how much data of Americans is incidentally, quote unquote, collected based on these foreign investigations, which they're technically allowed to do, but obviously is a major loophole in terms of the bulk collections of Americans' data. And additionally, one thing we pointed out is that this raw data from the so-called incidental collections can be searched by the FBI for one, actually with a couple others, without a warrant. And we don't even know how much that happened, although we do know that agencies other than the FBI, who knows who, used 5,288 search terms, quote-unquote, associated with Americans. So it's happening. The report also showed an interesting drop in requests in two specific areas, the PIN register trap and trace request and national security letters. As for the first, the so-called PIN register trap and trace, basically all that really means is that it records the numbers dialing into and being dialed on a particular phone line. Now, the government has to get a warrant from intelligence courts for this, although in 2013 it was revealed the DEA was doing this on a massive scale without any sort of warrant. But nevertheless, the number of those requests dropped markedly from 456 in 2015 to 41 in 2016. National security letters are one of the scariest new powers in the Patriot Act. Without a warrant or oversight, the government can use an NSL to compel an internet service provider and or phone company to hand over information on your data. And it also comes with a gag order so that neither the target nor the company can ever reveal it is happening. Now, some questioning at Congress and some documents released via lawsuits have shown that the FBI in particular was routinely abusing national security letters to get information without having to get a warrant. Now, the number of NSL cases dropped from 48,642 in 2015 to roughly 24,000 in 2016, dropped by about a half. Now, there are two plausible and very relevant things that could be happening behind these drops that raise some other questions. Either the methods of collecting intelligence are not very effective, which, of course, should then make us want to revisit whether or not the potential for abuse is worth them even having the power, or the government has found an easier way to obtain the same information, which also seems pretty relevant because it could apply to abuses elsewhere in the program. So on balance, certainly better we got this report than not getting it. However, it raises as many questions really as it answers. The reality is the ODNI is still shrouding most government surveillance in so much secrecy, it is difficult to evaluate at all if the immense powers that have accrued to intelligence agencies are worth the alleged benefits that they quote-unquote keep us safe, or if in fact they do quote-unquote keep us safe. It also points in the direction of tremendous abuses that could take place without appropriate safeguards, which, of course, can't be established if only the intelligence agencies and a handful of government officials actually know the relevant information used to evaluate such programs. So while it's good the NSA has opened up a little, we need to throw the door open and shine some light on the massive information panopticon that they are running out of Fort Meade. Chokwe Antar Lumumba, who's the son of the former Jackson mayor Chokwe Lumumba, has won the Democratic primary, which is the de facto election for the mayor's race in Jackson, a triumphant return after several years of the failed administration of Tony Yarbor, who won the special election following the untimely death of the elder Lumumba in 2014. Now, the father had won the election on a left-leaning reform platform, but it was very surprising at the time because Lumumba had been a 30-year activist with the Republic of New Africa, which is a radical group that faced a lot of repression down there in Mississippi. His son, Shoukry Antar, had lost the runoff right after he died in 2014, more or less for the same reason. This time around, though, it was the opposite in some ways. The radical ideas he had worked in his favor. That Shoukry Antar, Jackson's facing enormous development challenges. The last mayor didn't really do anything at all. And as the main newspaper, the Clarion Ledger, pointed out, and what many people seem to have agreed with, it was better to have a mayor willing to try something after so many years of less than visionary leadership. They're pushing things like cooperatives and things like that around employment, community gardening, other types of ideas, along with participatory budgeting and other ways of governing the thing. So pretty big grassroots victory built by 30 years of consistent organizing by radical cadres in the city with the help of progressive forces around the country, something that a lot of folks should be looking at as they wonder how energy from the streets is in fact translating to the ballot box. Those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
Well, we're just happy to be joined for this conversation here by one of our regular favorites, Anoa Chenga, host of The Way with Anoa, and Donna Davis, first time on this show, but not my first time talking to her. She's a co-founder of Black Lives Matter Tampa and does a lot of work down there in the, I guess, Bay Area, not the San Francisco Bay Area, but the Florida Bay Area on a lot of these issues. Thank you both so much for joining the show.
Thank you for having us. Thank you for having us.
No, of course, of course. And so I wanted to start here off the top with the Alton Sterling situation. The federal government came out yesterday. No real surprise, I don't think, for many people, but no charges on the federal civil rights case. And Noah, I'll start with you here since you are an attorney. Were you at all surprised that there were no federal civil rights charges in the Alton Sterling murder?
No, considering how many times we've been at this place, regardless of who has been in charge of the DOJ, I'm not surprised at all. I mean, we rarely actually see federal, I mean, because that's such a high standard. And I'm not even making a judgment because I think that they're actually, in more of these cases, there is the ability to bring the charges, and the federal government's often very reluctant to do so. But the problem with, you know, civil rights, even when you think into stuff like racial discrimination, the way the legal standard is set so high in favor of the state actor that it is difficult to bring these cases on the federal level. And we really do need to put more pressure on state, county jurisdictions to really start addressing, you know, these issues under regular laws that exist, which are applicable in all these different scenarios that we're seeing. So, no, I wasn't surprised at all when this happened.
You know, Donna, I'm curious your thoughts about this as well. I mean, it just seems like, you know, one of the things that hit me about this was, you know, here we are, you know, 2-3 years deep into, you know, this, I think, sort of whole new look at how police murders and police brutality are taking place. And it just is so stark to me, kind of what Anoa was saying there about how high the bar is that, you know, for Black people in America, to some degree, we actually are still trying to prove that something that is obviously the result of the pervasive racism in our society is in fact racist.
We have a system that's set up to do exactly what it's doing. You know, the problem that we've had with the reformists and the Black Lives Matter and the movement for Black Lives movement has been that people say, let's fix the system. And we insist that the system is not broken, that the system is an extension. This is a new iteration of Jim Crow, Chinese exclusion. You've seen recently the Muslim bans. This is a war against people of color, and it's not just limited to the American South or the United States. If you look at the populist trends around the world, these things are designed to dishearten, marginalized and disenfranchised and dispossessed people, and to kind of close us in and say, listen, there's no way that you're going to win this. So you can just stop marching. It's laughing in our faces. I think that our move, because we know this is going to continue, and it hurts, but with our hearts in our hands, we have to create a local strategy, because that's the low-hanging fruit, right? Where we're putting pressure on our local officials. We're putting people in our state legislatures that support what's right, that we really are doubling down on our efforts to change the fabric of local and state politics. That's the long game for this, the long game answer, I think, to that.
Well, and Donna, let me ask you a follow-up there, too, which I think is sort of relevant to Florida, because I believe you also did some work around the Marissa Alexander case that was there in Florida. Obviously, we had Trayvon Martin, and it seems like even though Alton Sterling was in Louisiana, one of the things that people raised where they're like, oh, well, he had a gun, but this is like Louisiana when basically anyone anywhere can carry a gun at any time. This sort of double standard, like if you're a black woman defending herself against a domestic abuser or black girl in the case of Breisha Meadows, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you're a criminal if you try to defend yourself. If you're a black person who legally owns a gun like Philando Castile or Alton Sterling or whatever it may be, then all of a sudden you're a threat. But if you're George Zimmerman or someone else, then you're just, you know, quote unquote, standing your ground. I mean, it seems like there's a huge double standard in sort of how the police and the criminal justice system acts with people who are armed if you're white or if you're black.
Well, guns are, the Second Amendment is not for black people. The Second Amendment is used to protect, for white people to protect themselves against the dark hordes, if you will. So the difference between a white man being able to walk down the street with a rifle strapped to him, as opposed to a black man seen putting his gun on his person, which he had a permit to carry, and then being tackled in a Walmart in Brandon, which is 20 minutes from my house, because that independent acting white man doesn't believe that a black man should have a gun. And then with John Crawford, the police are called because a man is seen looking at a gun in a store and is shot down without question. Again, Tamir Rice in the park across the street from his house, playing with a gun, shot down and said to have been believed to be an adult, as if that actually created any weight, additional weight there for the killing that took about 1 second. So if we look at American history from the Black Panthers in the State House, if we look at the saddling of Black Americans with felonies for the slightest crimes, and then having one of those conditions of their conviction being having their right to carry a gun taken away, the pattern that emerges is very clear.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's 100% correct. Noah, about a minute to the first break, and one thing I'm just curious about that you may or may not even know the answer to. I mean, is in the case of Alton Sterling, would it still be possible for his family to bring a civil suit on a civil rights basis and maybe see more success?
Yeah, I believe so. I don't believe that the DOJ's criminal proceedings would preclude bringing a 1983 suit. It's a somewhat different standard. I mean, still, you know, deals with the color of law, but you know, civil suits, the civil standard in our legal system is less, you know, than the criminal standard. As we saw, prime example everyone's familiar with is the OJ case. You know, OJ was not guilty criminally, and he was hella responsible civilly. So it's a different standard across the board.
It is. It is indeed on so many levels. And we've got a few different standards that we want to touch on here as we continue this conversation. So we are going to move to a break here on By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. We're going to be back with both our guests. So stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we are back here, and we continue to be joined here, and we're having a sort of a broad conversation here touching on a lot of the implications coming out of some of the more recent news we've had over the past couple days on police murders and killings. And again, we're joined by Anoa Chenga, host of The Way with Anoa, and Donna Davis, who's a co-founder of Black Lives Matter Tampa, an activist down in that area and really all across the state of Florida. And so, you know, Donna, I want to just sort of keep it going here with a similar issue that I think is certainly very relevant, which is that this guy, Michael Slager, the officer who killed Walter Scott down there in South Carolina, shot him in the back, planted the taser on him. He has now pled guilty to federal civil rights charges, could be facing up to life in prison, actually. And my first thought about that whole thing was whether or not this really calls into doubt The way the Obama administration, I mean, I think myself, along with a lot of people on a lot of these cases, would have loved to see them be more aggressive in bringing charges, and they weren't. And now seeing this guy pleading guilty to the federal civil rights charges after he got a hung jury in the state case seems to sort of be a black mark there on the Justice Department in the Obama era on this issue. But I'm curious your thoughts.
You know, I've said many times, and I continue to say, that if you are the head of an empire, I think it automatically implicates you as an imperialist. And imperialism cannot work unless the people who drive and make the rules for the empire are not satisfied. And it was the job of Obama to give us the optic that we were moving forward. Right? The aesthetic was amazing for black people and for people who wanted to believe that the country is moving forward. On the other hand, not very much changed. A lot of people got deported. There was a lot of performance of blackness, a lot of singing of Al Green and dancing, but nothing really changed for black people, and that is the static nature of an empire. In order for it to survive, it has to, at a minimum, maintain its position, and at best, it will continue to expand and continue to perpetuate the behaviors and the policies that made it what it is.
No, I think very, very, very relevant points there. Noah, I'm curious your thoughts on the same subject. I mean, one of the things I was talking to someone about this before we knew the Michael Slager thing over the course of this weekend. Obviously, we're coming up on the 25th anniversary of the L.A. uprising. And one of the things I always point out to people is that those cops in the Rodney King thing, they got off in the California trial. And then Bill Clinton and the Justice Department swooped in. They tried them. I think they only convicted 3 out of the 5 or 2 out of the 5 or whatever, but at least they sort of threw everything against the wall that was stuck. And I said, it just shocks me that in more of these cases, the Obama administration didn't at least try to get a couple in there. And now seeing the Slager thing, I don't know, but your thoughts on that in general and anything that Donna just gave us as well.
Well, I absolutely agree with what Donna said. But I also think that when we look at what the mechanism that happened here, I mean, The federal civil rights charges, like, that is like an additional, that's a completely separate, you know, thing, right, under federal law. We have, and going back to Donna's, the first segment, about how we really got to put pressure on our local officials at the state and the county, you know, these different levels of government where we have people who are in charge of upholding the law. I mean, the law is what it is on the books. And when we have people who are acting illegally, it's clearly not justifiable. You know, you go down the whole long list of things. There should be not only charges, but these people need to be actually, we're talking about these people, we're talking about these state's attorneys, these county prosecutors, they need to actually be owning the damn case and litigating them appropriately and effectively to get a just outcome. And we often, in so many cases, see where these people are acting more like a defense attorney for the police than actually representative of the people. And as we see in so many outcomes, we saw this in Tamir Rice's case with the county prosecutor who lost his job, basically, because Tamir's mother and others organized to get him ousted. We saw the same thing happen down in Florida to Angela Corey. I mean, we see this happening, but we need to have somebody ready and waiting, basically, to run to replace them as well, right? So we have multiple layers of strategies. So, and just thinking about, you know, the way in which these cases play out, I think it might have been the Luis Baez case. I can't remember. Some older cases from New York where there were cops who got off. I mean, the same thing with Abner Luima. In the Abner Luima case, it would actually end up being federal charges because that actually ended up being the charges that were brought, and not, we didn't see anything happen on the state side. So we've had too much reliance, I think, on being able to have the federal government, the DOJ, swoop in and make changes, and not enough consistent action until the past few years on the local level to build this up. It needs to be both and, because the federal government, that's like another layer to this whole process, but that still doesn't change anything that's happening at the state level. So I think that, you know, South Carolina, we saw this happen in a couple of different cases. You know, that hung jury, I mean,
having jurors like, well, I mean, when people are looking at the tape and being able to effectively get through people that your personal biases or the fact that you think cops are all good or whatever, they can do whatever they want to do, being able to explain what the burdens and what things are, that has to be owned by the state. And they have to do a better job of effectively adjudicating when it comes to black lives. And they don't do it. So we have to be prepared to have people who are supported across the movement. You know, we have some really great legal minds out there who need to be supported when they're running in these races, when they're stepping up and willing to put it on the line to actually, you know, advocate. Because it can't just be, you know, we get people voted out. We have to have someone who's going to come in and be able to actually make sure that things are done correctly when the time comes to bring things to trial.
You know, I think that's a great point, and it raises something in my mind, too, Donna, is also consistent engagement. I mean, I think a lot of times people get excited about a race that they sort of hear about nationally. They donate money, they donate whatever, and they move on. In the case I'm thinking about, you probably know where I'm going with this, Aramis Ayala. I mean, everyone was all about her being the first black woman, I believe, to be like in that position as state's attorney or whatever it may be. And then she's, you know, she runs on the whole thing saying, I'm not going to go after the death penalty. Then she refuses to bring the death penalty. And next thing you know, the governor is trying to remove her from her position. And I feel, you know, whatever, I don't want to just blanket say no one cares about this or whatever, but it seems like you didn't get the same level of excitement. And I mean, outraged excitement, but you didn't get the same level of outraged excitement you got about the fact she's getting nooses sent to her office and under attack from Rick Scott than you did with all the sort of national groups sending out emails, patting themselves on the back, saying, oh, we raised some money for Aramis Ayala.
Yeah, I was one of the organizers on the rally to tally for Aramis Ayala. And we had a really difficult time, even with Colorist Change, backing us up and sending out emails and invites to all of the people that are in their email list. We still had a very difficult time. We had the most people come in from Orlando. But for Tampa, for instance, we've got 10,000 people that we're able to talk to. We were successful in getting 25 people on the bus to go to Tallahassee from Tampa. So we ended up with a total of around 300 people in Tampa from throughout the state. And this was a free trip with a free lunch. And we were not able to get people, even our seniors who are retirees, to get on that bus and go up there and rally for Aramis Ayala. So, no, you're not wrong in that assessment. And it follows this. If we're in a situation, we have to continue to show up in these public spaces. It's one of the things that Black Lives Matter has been very successful. Our showing up in public spaces immediately after the Muslim ban was passed, we were able to put 1,000 people in contrast to 300 from throughout the state in the street for to protest the Muslim ban. 9 hours. So when you think about that, and you saw that reflected all over this country, thousands of people shut down JFK, Denver, Seattle. We gave cover to the federal judges who were then able to say, to feel, you know, allow themselves to be compelled by their legal expertise and also by the people in the streets saying, this is not the country that we want to live in. This flies in the face of human rights. And so being able to continue to keep that pressure of showing up en masse in public spaces, and the people represented in those public spaces, they are delegates for thousands, millions more people who were saying no to that. So our task is going to be to continue to educate people. We invite them. We excite them with the rallies and the show of power in the streets. We educate them, and then we activate them to go out and act as agents of change. And so we're in that final phase where we are educating people, and we're hoping that that education gets deep enough so that people understand how important it is after the election, you know, after the confetti has been cleaned up, are we still showing up for these elected officials, these mayors, these state attorneys? And if we're not, we're going to have a problem getting the results and the impact that we're seeking.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very relevant point. And thinking of places where people you know, did stay engaged, and now I've gotten some win. I want both your thoughts on this. I'll start with you, Anoa. Shokwe Antar Lumumba won the Democratic primary yesterday, May 2nd, which is basically the election in Jackson for mayor, coming back after his father had tragically died, had this neoliberal guy, Tony Yarbrough, sneaks in here. Big win for on a lot of different sectors. Just give me some of your thoughts coming out of that.
Like I said all over my Facebook page last night, folks need to trust black progressives and black leftists and watch us work in the Deep South. Like, seriously, listening to Donna gives me life. But seriously, though, like, I really, it's been great watching, you know, more of the establishment progressive groups like your DFAs and, you know, even working families, other folks, you know, everyone got really excited around Chokwe's race. And I think it's crucial. It's inspiring. It's so many different things, but it illustrates three things for me, really. One, this is the importance of having a relationship and a base in your community, right? You're saying, I want to represent you. I want to help build something, because what Big Chokwe left behind and what he helped build with his children and other family members, and what, you know, Chokwe Antar stepped into, he didn't just get it handed off from his dad. You know, we look at, you know, we talk about political, you know, lineages and stuff. He really worked and helped develop his own presence as a leader, right? He lost the mayoral race previously, but still kept working, still kept doing, and then came back even stronger and now won the primary resoundingly, right? No runoff, over 50% of the vote. My stepfather was friends with Big Chokwe, and I called him this morning. I was like, Dad, Chokwe won. He was like, well, I didn't know that. I said, because you're not on social media. You got to get on social media, Daddy. But I think that building that relationship and that endurance and still working through, even when you don't necessarily win a race, is crucial to folks who are running all over the place, no matter where they are. Two, again, progressive and progressive ideals, really black nationalist ideas, right? We're talking about the Malcolm X grassroots movement, can win in the Deep South. You know, Democrats and progressives and mainstream white progressives want to run away from issues of identity, and we shouldn't talk about certain things. And the opposite is actually true. We need to embrace stuff. We need to own it. We actually need to stand for something and then keep it moving. And then the third thing that I saw out of all this is really just the power, again, in people-driven movements and processes. You know, yes, the different small donors and folks came in, but that was still, you know, his sister, Cooperative Jackson, that whole crew in Jackson, that is something that's homegrown, that is built, that is love, right? And when you really put your stuff into something, when you're really building something like that, because that's been in the works for years. Way ahead of time. There's no quick fix. Democrats can't just come and see, look, so-and-so can win in this stuff. Yes, we know this, but it takes work. It takes time, and it takes investment in the community and the people. It's not just investing in a candidate that says the right things, but actually building those relationships and following through. And he knows that he's going to be accountable to those people, and those people know that he's going to be accountable to them. So it's a win-win for everybody. And I'm excited, and I'm jealous in Atlanta with our mayoral race.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't laugh. I shouldn't laugh, but you should be very jealous, and that should be a target for us. But you know how it is. The bourgeois Negroes down there got that in a chokehold. But Donna, your thoughts on the win of Chokwe Antar Lumumba in Jackson?
You know, when I met Chokwe in Harlem, we were at the Law for Black Lives conference in 2015, and he was talking about, he was very frustrated at the time, he was talking about how people just glazed over the South, that resources and interests of these movements didn't make it, didn't extend to Mississippi. And he was asking at the time, like begging for our support and our attention. I mean, I'm not in a really good position to help him, because being in Florida myself, I'm a part of that, you know, where are the resources, where's the help? But Mary Hooks and I spent some time talking to Chokwe. She's the BLM person in Atlanta. And he was such, even in his frustration, even in his anger, so brilliant and so humble. And the last thing that he said, because he looked so young, the last thing that he said was that he was a defense attorney, and he never spoke about his father. So when I became friends with him on Facebook, I was like, who is this kid? And then I look at his legacy, and then I compare that to his presence and his brilliance, you know, such an expanded mind and being, and to see the work that he's doing down there. And there's something else in that narrative around Chokwe and what he's doing.
the population of Jackson, Mississippi, and the legacy of his father should have made that election a no-brainer. The fact that we were sitting, biting our nails, waiting on the outcome says something about the nature of politics and the level of engagement down there. And that speaks even further to the disenfranchisement of people, even when they compose the majority. I saw that when I was organizing in St. Louis County, that Ferguson, there are 67 law enforcement agencies and 91 municipalities. In St. Louis County, there are only 700,000 people. And I know that because I had it all on a map in my office. So when I look at what Tokwe is doing down there, I'm wondering if we're going to, one, be able to keep him safe because his father, that's all I'm going to say about that. And two, if the uprising is large enough and protracted enough to make other places that have similar demographics fear that, so that we're able to engage people and say, hey, we can do this. Look at that. And if we are living in a society where the government does not fear its people and we fear them, we're already going the wrong way. I hope that Tokwe is able to finish this in early June and that he puts this win puts a lot of other places in the South on notice that we're coming. And then we will, community organizers on the back end, handle the keeping the masses engaged for the long haul so that we can actually start putting in, getting some wins out of this. And we're going to lose some of these, but we have to keep people at the table because we're going to lose and lose and lose and lose so that 100 years from now, our children and our grandchildren can win. And I hope that's what Tokwe's election is the beginning of.
Yeah, that I think is what many of us certainly are hoping for, seeing that. And I mean, really just unbelievable in some ways. I agree that we were even concerned that he could somehow not win or succeed. But, you know, it reminds me, you know, in Alabama, for instance, and I don't know why I'm forgetting the exact district right now, Terry Sewell's district, which is, you know, speak about gerrymandering, basically all black people in Alabama in one congressional district. But she's probably the most conservative person in the CBC. And this is just crazy to me, Anoa, that, and I know I've said this to you multiple times offline, that like in maybe the blackest congressional district in America or close to it with three historically black colleges in there, a long, a deep history of struggle for so many years, that somehow the representative is the most conservative one in the CBC.
Well, I think it's the way we see. And so on the flip side, when I say Dems are running for identity, we do have this issue with weaponization of identity, right? And we do have the hand-groomed, hand-picked, chosen one who has the great story because she's from Selma, right? That's where Selma is. She's from Selma, if I remember her background correctly. And, you know, all anyone has to do is mention Selma, and that's it. Everyone will be quiet, despite the fact that Selma, despite its historical significance, is rife with economic issues, inequality issues, unemployment, drugs. It's all types of, you know, so her being from a place, and that place has been run down, and there's nothing really being done to help the people and actually work and rebuild folks. I mean, what does that really mean? So, I mean, there is a reluctance. Black people have a reluctance to challenge other black people. And shout out to Cori Bush, who has, you know, broken that trend by challenging, Lacey Clay in Missouri's first congressional district, in their upcoming primary. But we have to get away from that. I mean, the Congressional Black Caucus, the people might have been great in their heyday, some of them maybe, but we have an aging, you know, population of so-called black political leaders who are just passing the baton. And we just, you know, just having this conversation earlier, how we had here in Georgia, we had Hank Johnson and John Lewis leveraging their political capital to instill this centrist, you know, white golden boy in the Georgia 6th race to replace Tom Price when there was a sister in that race. Now, whether or not she would have been better or not, but can we actually nurture and develop, you know, strong, good black leadership that's actually going to do something to help benefit all of us, or are we just, you know, interested in supporting particular legacies? And unfortunately, when we look at the difference between, you know, maybe black liberals and neoliberals, however you want to get into those different terminologies, and the rest of us, that there's a stark difference. And so I do know that for a lot of us, you know, engaging in electoral politics has been like, whatever. But we've let people take too much of the map, not just in terms of the way Republicans have, but even in these very conservative, you know, black folks
who don't really do anything for the jurisdictions they represent, but they're really quick to turn a civil rights phrase or throw a fact out there to kind of get the racial, you know, group in line behind them, you know, against whatever, you know, intrusion of whiteness may come. So yeah, I mean, it's when you mentioned her before, I think it was during the when we were talking about the hearings, I think it was the Intelligence Committee hearings, we were talking about her and her questioning and stuff. It's like I would love to see if we could find someone down in the 7th District to run against her and see what it would take to really help organize.
Yeah, we'll definitely keep working on that. I think the people on this call are good folks. We're going to have to leave it there for today. We're going to come back now with another segment after this break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about, well, how the media shapes views on a whole variety of things and how that impacts the workings of our, I guess some would say so-called, some would say existing democracy here in America. And we are very happy to be joined by Professor Scott Althaus, who's the director of the Klein Center for Democracy at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Scott, thank you so much for joining the show.
It's a pleasure, Eugene.
You know, one of the things that I'm curious your thoughts are, and maybe sort of an initial question to kind of frame this, this is something that actually comes up a lot on the show, and I kind of sort of bandy this about, but I always say to people that, to me, it seems like sort of the pre-existing, you know, reality of what is credible is such a huge factor here. I guess what I'm really trying to say is this. I often don't feel when I look at the media that they aren't like, quote unquote, not covering both sides. I feel like usually they're trying to get some varying views on different issues, but that really it's sort of still within a broader generalized policy consensus. So for example, you know, a particular war may be good or bad, but not necessarily is the following question asked, like, well, do we need a giant military and all these other subsidiary issues around war? And that kind of maybe self-censorship amongst journalists by trying to stay within sort of a credibility bubble is also a huge factor. And what I think a lot of people perceive as media bias.
Yeah, and it's really important to understand that for journalists, mainstream journalists do not want to go out on a limb and say, trust me on this, just believe me. They're going to want to work with authoritative sources to document the claims that they're making, and that dependence on bringing authoritative voices in to speak credibly into the mainstream news is going to have an important limiting factor on what gets said and what perspectives get represented within that discourse.
Well, and especially since the media is certainly a business, I think, and there's a rush to have the first person with the scoop and so on and so forth, I'm curious, like, to what degree do you think the issue of, you know, quote-unquote access journalism, the fact that, you know, you want to be the first person, like, the source that's going to get something first and foremost, how much do you think that really affects the way journalists are covering things to sort of try to make themselves a better repository for, you know, a lot of these authoritative sources?
Well, outside of the context of covering military conflicts, I think that we see that tendency to try to be first with new information being a real change that's happened in our media system over the last 30, 40 years. That impulse has always been there, but it's today that we have the technology that allows journalists to act on that in a very rapid manner. And that is, I think, really making it difficult for mainstream journalists to fulfill their traditional mission of stopping to validate facts and to confirm things before they get reported. And that's creating a news media system that is kind of twitchy, right? Little bits of information come out. There's a lot of reaction. Maybe there's some self-correction or not. And that is a kind of a new dynamic in the news media system that we have today. But in the context of how a mainstream journalists cover military conflicts, that part of the system is going to display that kind of twitchiness in the context of covering the policy debates in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere domestically, it's going to be a different dynamic for journalists that are actually in areas of combat and covering what military operations are going on and how they're proceeding. There's going to be a very different dynamic that takes place in that environment that may work against some of these tendencies to rush out with the quickest information before validating that the facts that are being reported are really well grounded and documented.
And, you know, one of the things I'm curious about is how have you felt that, speaking of this very the big issue, that sort of the issue of quote-unquote sort of embedded journalism has affected the way wars are being covered? I mean, obviously, like, sort of in the Vietnam era, people were just sort of, like, jumping on helicopters and jumping off in a war zone and doing their thing. Now it's much more controlled. I think we saw that with the mother of all bombs controversy, where reporters were, like, trying to get in there and the U.S. government was limiting their access. You know, they were only going to get there through sort of having some brokered agreement with the U.S. government and or the Afghan forces. I mean, I don't know the history of media all that well, but it seems that since sort of the Iraq War, 2003 Iraq War era, this sort of embedded journalism phenomenon has become more and more of the information we're getting from the front lines. And I'm curious your thoughts about how that's affecting the coverage, or maybe not.
Well, actually, we should probably start a little bit with a history, because there is an important history that leads us to this point where we have embedded journalists. And a lot of that begins with the Vietnam War. In the aftermath of a failed military conflict, there was a lot of thinking about what went wrong and what can we do differently. And one of the lessons that the military felt that it took from that conflict is the perception that the press turned the public against the war. So if that is what happened, then it is in the military's interest to protect its own ability to exercise its options in the best way that seems right under the civilian leadership that guides the American military forces. So you want to control the information that gets out. When we get up to the next major military conflict, it's the U.S. invasion of Grenada under the Reagan administration. We have total censorship. Journalists are not allowed anywhere near the island for the first few days of the conflict. And by the time the invasion is over, the news coverage finally gets to show up on the ground. That sort of total control gets developed and refined over the next major series of conflicts. The Persian Gulf War is an important stepping stone, and that moves forward all the way until the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. And when the United States builds a military coalition to invade Afghanistan, we're at the modern pinnacle of the military's ability to control that media flow, because there was no on-the-ground access for Western reporters. It was too dangerous. So all the imagery, all the pictures that came out about the initial invasion phase in the fall of 2001 came from Department of Defense sources. And the only journalists that could report on what the military was actually doing in that theater of operation were heavily controlled by the military. But what the military found through that experience of enjoying the total control that it had been trying to aim for all these years since Vietnam, was that it was not good enough for controlling the media message anymore, because what had come up in the meantime was the satellite broadcasts from the Arab world that were competing with the messaging from the Western world. And those reporters could get access on the ground. They were reporting in Afghanistan about errant bombs that hit wedding parties, and there was no narrative from the Western side to counteract that. And as we moved into the invasion of Iraq, the military and the civilian leadership of the Department of Defense began to understand that it was actually in the military's interest to bring reporters into the front lines as much as possible to more fully document what American forces were doing, so that there would be a credible witness when allegations came up that Americans are targeting civilians or are indiscriminate in how they're conducting their combat operations. There would be credible witnesses in the media that would be able to speak to that. And that is how the current system of embedded reporting came to come about.
Certainly quite interesting. And speaking of controlling the media flow, and I think this is sort of a related issue, although not quote-unquote war, but perhaps trying to prevent war, I think a way this all kind of – a lot of the threads I'm picking up from you here, with that Ben Rhodes interview in the New York Times from last year, it made all the headlines where he was talking about the Iran deal. And he was like, you know, we just created this media echo chamber because we knew who the people were, we knew who they were talking to, we knew kind of what they needed, and we shaped it in such a way to get back the types of stories we needed. Now, of course, many of those journalists came out and said, no, we didn't get played, so on and so forth. I mean, I just thought found myself thinking, well, like, yeah, of course, what is the government going to do? But it just maybe sort of more bottom line for consumers of the media, it raises the issue of how much of what we're consuming in the media is constructed, I guess, as opposed to just like, you know, this is, you know, I just walked out on the street and this is what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's a we have to step back and think about things from the standpoint of what a reporter is doing day to day. Nobody has a magic mirror that tells them all the interesting things that are going on around the world that they should be reporting on. And so what news organizations and individual journalists have to do is to monitor governmental and other societal points of friction where things that are happening are bubbling up and become visible because a lawsuit is being filed or planes are taking off from a particular airport and they're going to bomb targets in another place. When those things become visible and they can be seen because governmental operations are documenting these things happening, or other actors, authoritative actors in society, the court system and so on, are documenting that things are happening, that's when reporters are going to talk about what is going on. And the dependency of the mainstream news system on these other societal actors to sort of get going and document things before the news media are going to is an important factor that shapes the kind and quality of information that comes out through mainstream media. So there's very little of what journalists end up reporting on through the nightly news or on cable or on the internet that doesn't start out in some way in the hands of authorities or other societal institutions. And the trick then is for a journalist is to figure out with the sources that I'm working with the institutions that I'm monitoring, what are the axes that are being ground in those places? What are the different voices that want to try to get media attention? And how can I, as a journalist, responsibly balance out the perspectives to make sure that the information that I'm presenting is both credible and a fair-handed vantage point to understand what is going on within these institutions? So it's a very challenging dynamic for reporters to at once have to second-guess the institutions that they're monitoring, but also be dependent on the raw material that those institutions are putting out in order to tell us what's going on from day to day.
No, it's an incredibly difficult problem, and it's one I think about a lot, because one of the things, and this may happen to you and I think to some of our readers as well on a regular basis, people will say to me who I know, how do I stay involved with the news? Like, what do I need to read? And I find myself thinking, oh, well, why don't I make you a list of all the things I read, you know, on a daily, weekly basis? And then I find myself at the end of the list, I've got like 40, 50 sources on it. And I realize that, you know, I'm not really drawing from one source, but I'm trying to read as many things as possible about a particular issue and then sort of use conceptual skills to determine what I think about it. And it seems like that's something that is so lacking in our society that really heavily affects, you know, not only the consumers of media, but even a journalist for how you put these things together. Because, you know, I happen to take a basic intro to political science research class that changed my life, you know, where the guy who's a big pollster showed us how easy it is to manipulate polls, among other things. And I was like, whoa, this is crazier than I ever thought. But then I thought about how 98% of the people at the school, Howard University, did not take that class and didn't take any class similarly like it. So to some degree, it feels like, well, how can I give someone these 40 sources when I'm not even like, maybe I'm giving them information overload. Like it's not, you know what I mean? Like, I think it's that in and of itself seems like a huge issue that we have, is that in terms of how we consume media, we're not all sort of equally as equipped to kind of figure out, you know, where there may be this or that thing that we have to kind of parse or throw a grain of salt in.
Right. And, you know, there is no such thing as a magic mirror that's going to tell us all the things we want to know about. We have to go out and find that information. And it is the reality of the system that we live in that the best way to do that is to do exactly what you said, which is to follow a variety of sources that represent different perspectives and maybe have some different funding models that that help to shape what kind of journalistic coverage they give. That will give us a broader perspective. But even so, that's going to require us to have the time on hand to be able to track down all these different sources, and also just the background ability to make sense of the different perspectives, and more importantly, not just what's being said, but what's not being said, and developing a critical sense of What topics are being omitted? What voices are not in the news that could credibly be here, but somebody has made a choice along the way not to include them, to begin establishing a sense of where you might be able to find information about those voices and then go out and track them out. And for most of us, it's an almost impossible task to do all of that for ourselves. But that's why people can turn to radio shows like yours or other credible sources who do this aggregating and have developed a reputation as being trustworthy for tracking the issues that different groups of citizens find important, to be able to find those sources and to utilize them to do some of that heavy lifting for us. Because if we don't have a division of labor that we can turn to that has some specialists, and it used to be mainstream journalists for many people, doing that information gathering for us, then it is going to be a very heavy burden on ourselves to inform ourselves of all the things that we want to know about when we don't have the time to do that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm curious on that level. I mean, you do a lot of research, quantitative analysis on how you are viewing what I certainly seem to think is, over the past few years, I think maybe 538 kicked this off, but a rise in sort of quantitative analysis in the news. I mean, obviously there's 538, there's the upshot at the New York Times. I mean, I thought even that LA Times electoral tracking, daily tracking poll was innovative and interesting, and it turned out right to some degree on what was going to happen. And sort of the bringing of a lot of this into the news sphere, which may be included in that, I would add the much easier availability of quantitative and academic studies as PDFs on the internet.
Yeah, and I think the challenge with this move to more, there is a movement in journalism called data journalism, and 538 is one example of that, where we quantify things. And the challenge there is that, yes, that gives us some precision that allows us to speak about what would otherwise be fairly abstract things in very specific ways, but numbers can also take on a life of their own, and they can appear more authoritative than they really ought to be. And like the example you gave, Eugene, of the class that you were in, you want to know how the numbers came about in order to know what level of confidence I should have in them as an authoritative source. And that, again, is another area, in addition to media literacy, where we as a society need to really develop our skills and our critical thinking to be good consumers of that kind of quantitative information, which, as you say, is becoming more and more available and widely used within standard journalism organizations.
And how do you think this is defecting? Well, maybe that is the word, affecting the nature of our democracy. I mean, there is that Jonathan Gruber quote that I kind of hate, but the, well, we got the Obamacare through because the voters are stupid, you know, whatever, uninformed, stupid, not the same thing. Either way, I thought it was a relevant point to be made in terms of how policy takes place.
Well, I think there's a tendency to overstate what is novel and new today in a way that makes it seem like we've never experienced anything like this before. I think the nature of human communication is very complicated. And the system that we're seeing today has nuances and features that we haven't seen before, social media being a great example. But we have corollaries from the past. So there was information circulating outside mainstream news that had a function similar to social media in the past. Well, what's different today is the speed with which information moves through this very complicated system and the overall volume of information that's available to any one person at any one time. And I think there, scholars like me are struggling even today to understand a basic piece of knowledge like this fact starts at place A and ends up being transmitted to person B. What are all the steps that happen in between the start and end of that process? It is very difficult to track that down. And I think it is the speed and velocity and volume of all of this information coursing that's really new and novel today. Does that mean that we have some new challenge on hand for protecting the health of democracy with all this information deluge? I think we do have some challenges. But I think underlying it all, the fundamental dynamics of how people make voting decisions and what moves people to action, to stop just sort of thinking, maybe I should go out and do something, to actually do it, those fundamental dynamics are probably not very different today than they were 50 or 100 years ago. It's just what goes on top of them has changed.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that that is a great point and a good place for us to leave it here today. That was Scott Outhouse from the Klein Center for Democracy at the University of Illinois. That's going to do it for us here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Pergier. See you next time.
By Any Means Necessary.